Our next guest on Downtown writes about music for the Wall Street Journal, has a daily blog called jazzwax.com, and is also the author of a book entitled Why Jazz Happened and a brand new oral history of pop, rhythm and blues and rock music called Anatomy of a Song. Mark Myers joins us this afternoon. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Rich, how are you?
I'm doing well. I absolutely love the book. It was such a great read. It was about a one-nighter. I had to stay up and finish it. It was so good.
Oh, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
And the book, the genesis for it really began with your Wall Street Journal columns about music.
Yeah, it did. You know, it was a column that we were sort of, at first it was sort of a write-through column. In other words, I'd interview somebody and there'd be quotes in it. But somewhere along the line, about three columns in, I suddenly realized this would feel a lot better for the reader if it was just an oral history. Get me out of the way and let the words of the composer, let the words of the musicians come through so that the reader could experience that feeling of talking to the artist himself or herself.
Well, it was so interesting to hear the words of the creators of some of the great music. What was your criteria for picking? Because you chose, and often when people write about music, they focus on the albums. Why did you choose to focus on singles?
You know, singles, I think, for one, there's a huge impact with singles. They're designed to really leap out of the radio and grab the listener. And singles have a long history. You know, really, the 45 runs from about 1952 all the way up into the 80s, and probably many of them are released today in the vinyl age, the vinyl revival age. But these songs were all sort of, I don't know how to put it, Rich, like they were sort of off the beaten trail, but you still know them. In other words, they aren't the ones you expect, but they're the ones you say to yourself, oh, man, I know that song. I wonder what the story is behind it.
Well, and you've talked to an absolute who's who of popular music of the last 60-plus years. My gosh, from Lloyd Price to Ronald Isley of the Isley Brothers, Dion DiMucci, Ray and Dave Davies, Grace Slick, up to Mick Jagger, and on and on. And also along the way, as happens when you're researching and talking with guys who were in their 60s and 70s and beyond, some of those folks have since passed away, and I think that not only adds a poignancy to the book, but it really makes this a valuable historical document.
Oh, thanks, Rich. Yeah, for me, it's a crusade. I mean, this music was so important to me as a kid. I mean, now, when I say a kid, I mean growing up in grade school, then junior high school, then high school, then, you know, in college, then after college. I mean, these artists worked so hard to create a soundtrack, you know, for my life and probably many of your listeners' lives, that for me, I felt like I needed to go in and save their stories before they passed on, save their stories before they forgot stuff, so that readers who love this music and their kids who listen to the music too had a way in which they could understand how this music came to be.
We're talking with Mark Myers. His book is entitled Anatomy of a Song. And, of course, along the way in telling these stories, we also see the creation and the merger of musical styles, whether it's rock coming up out of some combination of country music and rhythm and blues, and then in later years, the merger of rock and hip-hop with Aerosmith and Run DMC getting together.
Yeah, what I wanted to do in this book was to create a book moving in two different directions. It was very calculated. I remember my editor cornered me at a Christmas party before I started to write it, and he said, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with this? And I said to him, I'm going to get rid of all the original introductions, and I want all of the introductions to move horizontally, meaning that if all you did was read the introductions, you would get the history of R&B and rock and roll. And that's the force you feel. I mean, when you couldn't put it down at night, what you're feeling is that centrifugal force moving horizontally, pulling you to the next story, to the next chapter. And then also vertically, that you would read down, you'd read that little introduction, then you'd go right into the oral history and learn about the song. So you were learning about the history and then learning specifically about the song as well in each chapter.
Well, and I was pleasantly surprised because I didn't look at the table of contents on purpose when I started reading the book. And you know, whenever people
That's a great idea. I never thought of that.
When people ask me what kind of music I like, I always say good music. And I don't stick to a genre. And man, as I rolled into chapter 17, and I was thrilled because early in my radio career, I did country radio, and to read the interview with Loretta Lynn talking about Fist City. And for people who don't know Loretta Lynn, what she meant to music as a trailblazer, not only in recording songs that had a pretty sharp edge to them, but primarily songs that she wrote.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, when there's only a handful that I interviewed the subject live. That's primarily my choice. In effect, I really wanted to do these by phone. And because you get so much more by phone. When you interview somebody by phone, it's like 8 o'clock at night, and they're in England or wherever they are, and they're sitting back, and their eyes basically, you can hear their eyes close, and you can hear those stories coming as they remember back. Sometimes live, you know, interviewing these people live can work against you. But in the case of Loretta Lynn, when I sat down to interview her, I mean, by the time that interview was over, my face hurt. I was laughing so hard. I mean, you know this. That country humor of Loretta Lynn, where she just rock and rolls you, and then she's just tickling you silly, so you're crying uncle. I mean, she's just very, very funny. So interviewing her was a joy for many reasons, to get the story, but also to hear that humor, that log cabin humor up close, really, really charmed me.
And also another surprise for me, and as you mentioned, that you didn't just focus on the hits. An album that meant so much to me as a young guy, high school age, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, and I was fascinated to read about the song that leads off the album that's always been one of my favorites, Love's in Need of Love Today.
Yeah, I mean, I was so surprised when I interviewed Stevie. It was really surprising to hear. I mean, I really wanted to ask the naive questions. You know, I wanted to understand, okay, you know, since you cannot see, how do you write this music? How do you remember it? How do you hold on to it? How do you go through the various stages of creation, then into the studio, then into the mixing and polishing? I mean, how do you carry that along? And, you know, there was a point in that interview where I asked him a question about writing that song, and the line went quiet. And I said to myself, Rich, I said, oh, my God, I asked the wrong question. He's going to want to get off the phone. He's going to tell me that's it. It's over. And he suddenly says, can you hear me, Mark? And I said, yeah. And he had gone into his studio, and he illustrated the writing of the song by singing the entire song for me on the phone. And, I mean, wow. My teeth were like about a quarter of an inch into the back of my hand, you know, telling myself, do not ask a question. Say nothing. Do not say a word while this man is singing.
Oh, that's incredible. So many wonderful nuggets that you unearthed along the way. I love the connection between Jim Morrison and Frank Sinatra on Light My Fire.
Yeah, well, you know, when I interviewed the Doors, I said to John Densmore, the drummer, I said, you know, that main section of that song is so, there's something so infectious about it. There's something so sexy about it. There's something so compelling. You just love listening to it. I said, it sounds to me like there's some kind of a Latin beat in there. I know that must sound weird, though. And he said, no, not at all. John Densmore loved Bossa Nova. He loved Girl from Ipanema. So what you're hearing on that main section of Light My Fire is John Densmore with a stick on the rim beating out a Bossa Nova beat. And he also told me that all the guys there listened to pop music, that Jim Morrison loved Frank Sinatra's Strangers in the Night, that he was listening to it, you know, throughout the summer of 1966. He loved Sinatra's sound, which makes sense, you know, when you hear that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the other one that was really interesting was the inspiration behind Gladys Knight and the Pips' Midnight Train to Georgia.
Wasn't that great? You know, the songwriter, Jim Weatherly, he came up, his friend was Lee Majors, the $6 million man, and he called Lee Majors up. It was a football question that he had, and he called him up, but Lee wasn't home, and his girlfriend at the time was Farrah Fawcett, the pinup model from the 70s. And Farrah Fawcett said, listen, Jim, I'm sorry, you know, Lee isn't home, but I've got to go, man. I've got to catch a midnight plane to Houston. And, you know, Jim says, okay, great, sorry to bother, and, you know, catch up down the road. So he gets off the phone, strokes his chin, and he says, wow, Midnight Plane to Houston. What a great title for a song. So he writes a song called Midnight Plane to Houston. It's a ballad, sort of a country ballad. He records it. He puts it on an album of his songs, and his manager sends it out, which is what they do, sends it out to all these big singers with hopes that somebody will record one of these songs and make Jim very, very wealthy. Well, you know, he gets this call from Sissy Houston, Whitney Houston's mom, who is a recording artist in her own right. And she says to Jim, listen, I love this song. I want to record it. And Jim says, great. And she says, but I got a problem with your title. And he said, what's wrong with the title? And she said, well, my folks aren't from Houston. They're from Georgia, and they take trains, not planes. I want to rename it Midnight Train to Georgia. And Jim says, fine. And then she comes out with her recording, doesn't do that well. But then Gladys Knight, of course, you know, hears Sissy Houston's version, and she turns it into the version that we know.
Interesting. You mentioned football with Jim Weatherly, because he was the quarterback of the unbeaten University of Mississippi football team back in the early 60s, before he got into
summer. Very good. Yeah. That's right. And he was actually calling because they had a flag football team. Remember flag football?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so imagine Lee Majors and Jim Weatherly are playing flag football post, you know, in their so-called, you know, acting and song recording days. Kind of funny.
Of all the people, and you talked to so many wonderful talents along the way, who was, to you, who was perhaps the most surprising in their openness to share their story?
I think Joni Mitchell. Joni wanted me to come out to interview her at her house. Of course, I didn't. I gave her that option. I said, look, I'll come out and interview you there, and we can do it on the phone. And she said, why don't you come out? So I flew out to Los Angeles, and in a, sort of an October Los Angeles afternoon, in I think it was 2014, sitting on her patio, we did 2 hours. And she talked openly about her relationship with Graham Nash and how terrible the breakup was and how that sent her abroad with a friend to sort of overcome it. And she was extremely open to the point of rawness. I mean, she just gave me everything that she had. And then, you know, it's funny, when I got back to New York, she called me up and we did 2 more hours on the phone as she clarified things and got into more detail. But to have somebody like that, you know, open up their soul and give you everything they've got on the meaning of a song and their relationship and their feelings, you know, it's an enormous amount of response. You know, I feel I have an enormous responsibility to get that story right, get it accurate, and make sure I convey the artist's poetry and the beat of their heart.
I was really taken with your description of her eyes as she talked to you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When you do it live, you pick up on certain things, like I said with Loretta Lynn, just being so funny. Loretta had a funny way of, you know, she had this way of taking a drag, making a point, taking a drag, and her eyes would sort of lock on mine. And it was, the way I describe it in the book, it was almost like a mom taking her kids to the bus, putting the kids on the bus, and then following them onto the bus to make sure they're getting seats and sitting down. And that's how she was with her words. She'd say something, you know, she'd take that drag, and then she'd turn her head slightly, but her eyes would be completely fixed on me to make sure that the words went in my ears and registered in my face, that I understood the point she was making. It was kind of interesting.
It is an absolutely fascinating read. Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. Mark Myers, thank you so much for being with us.
Rich, great interview, and I've done a lot of them. This was fabulous.
Well, thank you much. We'll talk again.
Thanks much.
Mark Myers on Downtown.